Hello and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB 19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy!
So we'll move on to our last speaker, who is Beth, who is a neonatologist from Bristol, and he's going to talk about neonatology things.
Neonatology things, yeah. Just to say for the start, this talk is a lot less scientific than the other two, and it's very practical. It's not hugely evidence-based, it's just kind of my opinions and my ideas, but, you know, they're valid as well, aren't they? So Tessa asked me, could I come and give you a talk about neonatal procedures? And she said, could you just talk about stuff that's not actually very easy to publish, but it's really helpful if you are dealing with a sick baby? So I had a think about how I can do that in this kind of format, like giving a lecture, because actually I'm talking about skills here, and this is like a hands-on thing. So you'll see, hopefully, as I take you through the talk, that I've kind of looking at it from a slightly broader perspective. So thinking about, well, what are the goals when we're doing a procedure in a sick baby? And I think they sort of fall into two categories. You're either doing something to stabilise a patient, so airway breathing, circulation, vascular access, central access, or you might be doing diagnostic procedure like a lumbar puncture, for example, or a blood test. So whenever you're doing any kind of neonatal procedure, I think the thing to think about is, what things have I got control over that will increase my chances of this going well? So I'm quite pleased with my slides with the little buttons. Sorry, it's a bit sad. Okay, so things that I can control regarding the patient. So this is a really important message that I wanted to sort of say to people. If you're in an emergency department or a children's ward and you're asked to go and see a sick baby, it's probably a pretty scary situation. I mean, for me, that's my everyday job. But if it's not your everyday job, it's something that probably fills you with a bit of dread. And what you really don't want to do is make a bad situation even worse, which is quite possible to do with a baby. And so I'm going to talk about that. Now, incidentally, this guy in this picture has a difficult airway, and we'll come on to that later. So making things worse. The way I think about the neonatal cardiovascular system, it's a little bit like, you know, the ring in Lord of the Rings, where it's always trying to return to its master? So the neonatal cardiovascular system is always trying to return to a time when everything was lovely, and that was when it was in utero, okay? So anything that causes instability in a newborn baby, the cardiovascular system will just revert back to having a right-to-left shunt. And you get this patient who's got blood diverting away from the lungs. They're blue, they're hypoxic, and they're sick. Okay, so, and that's a really important, weird kind of quirk of neonatology that we're very used to. But if you don't deal with newborn babies all the time, you might not be aware of this phenomenon. So things that cause clinical instability will promote this right to left shunt and make things even worse than they already were. So getting cold, being uncomfortable, being hypoxic, having a low blood sugar. Okay, so you want to avoid things getting worse than they already were in the first place. So don't let the patient get cold. Put a hat on it. Warm up the room. If it's a premature baby, make it like ridiculously uncomfortably hot for everybody else. Wrap the patient in a plastic wrap or these fancy Neo hoodie, very expensive versions. Actually, a polythene bag from Tesco's is probably just as good. That's patients under 30 weeks. We have trans warmers in our neonatal unit. I don't know if you're aware of them or if you have them in emergency departments, but they're fantastic. Really good bit of kit to put under a baby to keep them warm. And they're really, really cool as well if you're operating it, because you crack a thing and it goes all warm under your hand. That's quite satisfying. And then oral glucose gel is a really useful thing. Twofold. Number one, it's an analgesic. So that's good because you're going to give the baby analgesia for whatever procedure you're doing that might cause pain and therefore might give them pulmonary hypertension, and it'll also bring their blood sugar up without needing to get vascular access. So that's a very useful thing to know about. So I think what I really also wanted to emphasise is that it's really easy to get task focused when you're looking after a sick baby, isn't it? When you're doing a difficult procedure, and you almost need to be task focused in order to be successful. So you need to know how long you have been going, and you need to maintain situational awareness, and somebody needs to have their spider senses up and about to think, okay, how long have we been going? Is the patient deteriorating? So that's just a really important thing. thing to emphasise. So, I think before you're doing any kind of neonatal procedure, you need to just press the pause button and just think, hang on a minute, is this procedure absolutely necessary right now? Or could I actually risk making things already worse than they already are? So, once you have paused for safety and you think, yep, I'm definitely going to go ahead with whatever the procedure is, then how can we make it likely that we're going to be successful? So, the next thing I want to think about that you control is yourself as the operator, the person doing the procedure. And I sort of broke that down into kind of my mindset and then my physical kind of fine motor skills. So thinking about yourself, I don't know if you know the acronym HALT, so it stands for hungry, angry, late, and tired. This is really, really important, okay? You cannot put in a difficult neonatal vascular access if you are hungry, okay? You need to stop. You need to take your breaks. Make sure you have lunch. You know, don't skip lunch or eat a quick chocolate bar before you go to your resus call. Lateness is actually a really, really important one that actually really affects me. So free yourself. Give yourself enough time to do the procedure. Give your bleep to somebody else. Phone ahead to the meeting and say, do you know what? Start without me. I am going to be late so that you've got enough time to focus on your patient, because if you're rushing, it's not going to go well. And take breaks, take rests, make sure you're sleeping properly. So I wanted to tell you all about the drought. So this is a normal phenomenon. We all have days where we can't put in a cannula. Has it happened to you? Our clinical lead talks quite often about a time he had a 10-day drought where he couldn't get vascular access. It happens to everyone, so be kind to yourself and don't just think, oh my God, I'm terrible at my job, I'm going to quit, I'm going to go off and do something else. All of us have times where we can't do it. So be kind to yourself and have a plan B, okay? Have a contingency for if you can't get vascular access or an ET tube or whatever it is. So I've talked about the mindset. Now I want to talk about the fine motor skills. So, this is a guy, I wrote his name down, I think it's Graham Short, I think it's called. He is the world's smallest engraver. Here's my joke, he's not actually a tiny man. He engraves very, very, very small things. So he has like the most incredible fine motor skills. So he wrote the Lord's Prayer on the head of a pin, and you probably can't see it, but along this edge of a razor blade, he carved "Nothing is impossible." And these tiny, tiny writing, you can't see with the naked eye. And he's like some kind of elite athlete guy. He swims and he exercises all the time to get his resting heart rate down to about 30. And then he does these pieces of art, which sell for like a lot of money. He makes them in the middle of the night when there's no traffic going around. He listens to his own heartbeat with a stethoscope and he carves the strokes to do this writing in between his heartbeats. So he must have the most incredible fine motor skills and precision. And I guess I'm showing you him because he's trained for that. He's practiced and his whole kind of life is set up to have this like incredible fine motor skill. Obviously, it's just like being a neonatologist, isn't it, Hazel and James? So I just wanted to talk a little bit about becoming an expert in a skill that is a motor skill. So if you think about a virtuoso violinist, and just think about all the training and practice that they've gone through to get to being that good. No child is born a kind of musical genius. It's absolute bollocks. If you see somebody like one of these little kids playing their instrument, they've only got that way through practice, 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 practice. The next picture down is my little boy who's learning the violin, and he's doing his practice while we're camping on holiday, but he's just about to go swimming, so he's like in his full swimming kit and doing his practice. And it's been really interesting watching my kids learn musical instruments, because they're learning these kind of new skills. And a really important part about practicing is that you have to practice the correct technique. If you actually practice and your fingers are in the wrong place, you just reinforce that muscle memory of the mistake. And it's the same for doing anything, isn't it? So if you're doing vascular access or an ET tube or whatever, you need to practice good technique over and over and over again. There is no shortcuts. Sorry, I'm not going to give you any kind of shortcuts to becoming an expert at this. You just have to do it a lot of times. And that's why we use simulation, isn't it? That's a picture of us in our neonatal unit in Bristol doing a sim. And it's that's a good way to get those kind of, just to get the hours in. Those courses you can go on, I was going to plug the ARNI course, which is the Advanced Resuscitation of the Newborn Infant. Right, number of attempts. This is really important. So Liam Gallagher, apparently, when he's doing a track in the recording studio, he'll only have 2 attempts. And then if he can't get it, he gives up and he goes home. This is a bit of a precious prima donna like that. But actually, I think this is a really, really important concept. You shouldn't be having lots and lots of attempts at a procedure. Well, I'd probably say in any patient, but particularly a tiny, vulnerable neonatal patient. And the reason for that is a fewfold. Actually, firstly, you're very unlikely, like Liam Gallagher, to be successful if you just keep going over and over again. And there's data that shows that. So in Oxford, they looked at people doing lumbar punctures on babies. And basically, after 2 goes, if you don't get it, you're not going to get it. So limit your attempts, I would say, to 2. My second reason is that if you're having loads and loads and loads of attempts, it's really easy to lose situational awareness, lose track of how long things have been going on, and have that baby spiralling into pulmonary hypertension. And my third reason is, if you just have loads and loads and loads of attempts, you're really stuffing it up for the next person. So if you have loads of attempts of vascular access, the poor person who comes in next to try and all the veins are buggered. Or if it's an airway, you can really make the situation worse, because you had an airway in the first place, and now you've got an airway with blood in it, or it's all swollen. So limit the number of attempts that you have. It's really important. This is a picture of my dolls. So basically, there is a mannequin for most things. And I just wanted to show you the ones that I have. And I put them all out on the table and photographed them, and then thought, that looks really macabre and weird. So I'm showing you my dolls. We do procedure workshops at work so that people can practice actually the physical skill of doing things away from a real patient. Okay, yes, we're not being aseptic and everything there, but this is us learning a new technique to put long lines in using a Seldinger technique. And it's so useful to just rehearse physically, you know, what am I picking up after what, away from the clinical area. So we've looked at the operator, looked at the patient, so now and talk about the environment where you're doing whatever the procedure is. So I don't know about everybody else, but I cannot put a cannula in a baby who's in a cot. I just can't, so don't even try. Take the baby out, put them on a flat surface. Make sure you've got 360-degree access in case they get worse, in case they get pulmonary hypertension. You need to be able to deal with a deteriorating patient. Make sure they're fully monitored. Make sure you can see. You know, have the lights where you need them to be and have the patient at the right height. So those resuscitators with a uppy-downy thing, a movable surface, are really useful. And that's good also so that you're not hurting your back and things, but you're improving your likelihood of success if you do that. And I would say be precious. If you're doing a neonatal procedure on a sick, vulnerable baby, it is okay to say to people, can I have some quiet, please? Yeah, so be precious and control your environment. Any neonatal procedure is a minimum of a 2-person procedure. It really ought to be. That is the only way you can actually achieve asepsis. So you don't want to make things worse by introducing an infection where there might not even be one in the first place, especially with a preemie. It's the only way that you can get the baby properly in the right position where you need them to be, where they're held properly and they're still. And it's the only way that you can maintain situational awareness, because actually you have to get focused. You have to be really, really looking at the vein or whatever it is, and therefore you're not looking at the rest of the baby. So a neonatal procedure is a 2-person procedure. I'm not on commission, but ultrasound for vascular access in babies is not great, actually, unless you're going for a really big central vein. So for the tiny little veins, to get vascular access, a transilluminator is the best way, in my opinion. And this is a really, really good brand of transilluminators. They're quite expensive. We have them in our unit. They were bought by a charity. So like I say, I'm not on commission, but these are bloody good. So thinking about the environment, parents are part of the environment for this patient. So here's an interesting question. Do you have the parents in the room or not in the room when you're doing a procedure? Andrew Tagg asked this on Twitter recently. So I was like, oh, can I have your results of your poll so I can use it for my talk. And actually, there was a lot of people who felt this was about doing a lumbar puncture, that they don't want the parents in the room. But there was a mix of opinions. And I think just sort of scrolling through it correlated that usually the more senior the people, the more comfortable they were with having the parents in the room. And if you're relatively junior, maybe less comfortable. And I'm not sort of coming down on either side of the argument, actually. I was just going to say, it's just something to think about. What you're trying to do is what's in the best interest of the baby and maximise your chances of success. And I guess it's up to the person doing it at the time to think whether the parents being there or not is going to influence that positively or negatively. Okay, so the equipment that you're using to do this procedure. Some equipment is better than others. So all I would say about this is just be fussy and ask for what you need to be able to be successful. I think that's fine. So in our department, we have a lady called Bridget, who's our equipment technician. And she will ask people, like, what brand of cannulas do you like? What brand of long lines do you like? And then she'll order them for you. So you need to get to know your Bridgets in your departments and tell them what you want. And I'm sure that, you know, if you say, this is going to optimise my chance of success and wastage because I'm not using loads of whatever the equipment is, then they should get it for you. Some is definitely superior for others than others. So we think the Seldinger technique, for example, the Seldinger long lines do seem to be much better than the old style of long lines. We're still collecting data on proving whether that's the case. So now I wanted just to talk about just a couple of specific procedures to give you some kind of tips from me and people that I asked at work that might be useful. So first of all, neonatal airways. So I think a neonatal intubation is a difficult intubation just from the get-go. It's not it's more difficult than intubating a larger person because it's a small thing. But there are certain patients for whom you should have an alarm bell ringing and thinking, oh my God, this is going to be a really difficult intubation. So the classic one, I guess, would be a Pierre Robin baby with a small chin. You would really be worried about going into that airway and potentially making things worse than they already were. And another sort of really red flag would be a ex-preterm baby who's been in the neonatal unit for a long time who might present in your emergency department with stridor. You wouldn't want a junior person going into that airway. So there are a few airways where you'd be like, okay, right from the get-go, before I even start, I'm going to be worried. I've shown this slide to lots of people and nobody knew who it was. This is Plan B. He's a rapper. So you must have a Plan B for your airway. And I think James talked a little bit about laryngeal masks, and I will mention them later, but actually bag valve mask ventilation, there is much more in it than we realise, and studies are showing that masks leak, particularly when you're bagging and masking a patient, massively contributes to whether it's successful or not. And there are skills, definitely, fine motor skills that you can practice over and over again to reduce your mask leak and to optimise the gas that's actually going into the baby's chest. So I heard about the Difficult Airway Society a few years ago, and I'd never heard of them before, and I sort of thought, oh, that's a really weird name for a society, and I kind of imagined maybe their meetings kind of look something like this, and they're all sort of standing around having odd conversations about airways. But actually, the Difficult Airway Society produced guidelines for managing difficult airways for children over 12 months. But their principles of, you know, making sure that you've got a plan and that you're prepared and that you escalate appropriately are totally adaptable to the neonatal population. And as James was saying, it's really, we have been slow to adopt this in neonatology. This is our checklist at work. It emphasises preparing, making a change, and limiting the number of attempts, like I was saying before. There's an ARNI one as well. But yes, you're right, James. Not every neonatal unit in the UK has, as far as I'm aware, a difficult airway checklist. These are some bits of kit that you might have in your difficult airway box. I guess I would just emphasise the oropharyngeal airways. And again, going back to the basics of really good mask ventilation technique. Get out of jail free would probably in most cases, if the baby's large enough, be a laryngeal mask. I just wanted quickly to talk about vascular access, if that's okay. It's flashing at me that my time's up. Okay. So I'm going to tell you a secret here. Vascular access, or putting in a cannula, is the most difficult procedure in neonatal medicine, in my opinion. Okay, ET tubes, not that difficult. Chest drains, really not that difficult. Vascular access is a bloody nightmare, particularly in some patients, and it requires an awful lot of skill. And there's not really any shortcut, just hours and hours of practice and training, like I was saying before. I think it's worth being aware of the kind of fat distribution on the newborn. So the dorsum of the hand is the best place probably to go, and the dorsal surface of the foot. There are some nice veins that run along the inner side of the wrist, but they're quite thin and wiggly, and they blow quite easily. And there's a nice vein that runs up the ulnar surface of the forearm that for an ex-prem baby is a really good place to look. So I asked our ANNPs, who are advanced nurse practitioners, because they are the best people at getting vascular access that I know. And they said, make sure your own hands are warm. Spend a long time looking for the vein. And then this bit was funny, because I thought, really did think, God, you're really sounding like a ninja now. They said, before you even start, you've got to visualise the needle going into the vein and be sure. So that I'm telling you, that's what they said. Make sure you've got somebody holding the baby really still. Make sure that the baby's warm so the veins are sticking up. And then one of our previous ANNPs said, where there's hair, there is hope. So some really good veins on the scalp, and particularly the one that runs just in front of the ear. Umbilical venous access is definitely worth attempting up to 10 days after birth. So if you've got a collapsed neonate coming into ED, as well as obviously doing airway breathing, you know, your primary assessment, get someone to stick some wet gauze over the umbilicus so that it's soaking, and then you should be able to get a big central line into that baby pretty easily, actually. So I think neonatal procedures are about your mindset, your environment, and your skills. And that's the end of my talk.
That was fab. I think lots of really good tips there, not just for neonatology, for bigger.
For life.
For life. For life. A question?
I tend to agree with you about vascular access being a bit of a nightmare. Sorry, Stuart, but I'm from Wollongong in Australia, or Gosford, depending on who I'm sitting with. But the question I had for you was really about IO and what you're doing, because I think that's really interesting in a neonatal setting.
Yeah, so I would say it's a last resort. We have it. I've used it in the last year. I used it once and it fell out quickly, and another colleague with the same situation. But there's definitely a place for it, and it's something, again, that as neonatal doctors we would use relatively rarely, and so it's therefore important to train and practice and simulate. So, yes, we do, but and I can't think off the top of my head the weight it goes down to, but, you know, there's some caveats there, and it's not always, it's certainly not our first choice.
See, from my point of view, being EM background rather than peds, I would probably reach for the IO before the umbilical catheter. And I tend to as well ignore the weight on the packet and go with the length of the needle instead. And often if they fall out, it's because somebody's chosen a too short a needle. So if I feel it'll get into the bone, then I'll use it.
So I'd like to make a comment about IOs from my, because I do a joint paediatric and neonatal job. I think if you've got a sort of well child who needs antibiotic, keep going with your vascular access. If you've got a shocked child, two goes and you're out, put an IO in. And we are, as a practice, as an organisation, we are going more and more distal femur because people, just look, it's shockingly how bad people put them into proximal tibia. It's just nowhere near the tibia. but distal femur is a much, much better place in the smaller patients. But again, I have to say, any baby under 10 days old, please try and put an umbilical line in. And remember, get the best person to do it. Your paediatric trainees will know how to put an umbilical catheter in, and it is unbelievably easy. So I don't know whether she's in this room, but one of my colleagues from an ED PEM department last week put an umbilical catheter to resuscitate a 9-day-old baby. Yeah. So it's not just a thing of myth. It's not fairy tale. No. It happens.
There is a really good free app that I'll tweet out as well for learning IO sites, and in particular it mentions the distal femur, so it's useful. Any other questions or comments from the room?
A question for all the neonatologists. I just want to know, are you Do you think LMAs will replace bag mask valves in resuscitation of term babies? Or because, and I'm wondering if you're starting to teach that to non-tertiary NICU type people.
Not according to the UK Resuscitation Council. In fact, as James says, they're not even really mentioned on the basic life support course, which is NLS, although they are covered in the advanced life support course, which doesn't quite seem the right way around. But I think it's something we need to look into, because there is a lot of good data out there that shows that we're really crap at mask ventilation, and it's really difficult to do it in a tiny baby, so in a kind of 1 kilo baby or less, most of the gas that you're giving is not going into the trachea. The problem is there isn't an LMA either for a 1 kilo baby or less, so you're sort of the most difficult group. There isn't an obvious solution other than training to be really good at mask ventilation. But I think LMAs definitely have a place. I don't know if you want to comment, James, because you were talking about them.
Well, now do their revision, isn't it? So I imagine it will appear in there. That Cochrane review is new and says they work. I would use them as they do in adults. And, of course, you can't just stick an eye gel down every single adult, because if they've got any form of responsiveness, they just gag it back out again, don't they? So in the deeply unconscious patient, how many people have you got around? You know, if there's only me, well, they'll get an eye gel and they'll get chest compressions, you know, because I can't do bag valve mask and CPR at the same time. So how many resources have you got? How many team have you got around you? Who is good at bag? I don't think I'm very good at bag valve mask. There you go. So I just stick an eye gel down when I can.
It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because I think in neonatal medicine, you see the consequences of then practicing intubation less frequently. So when I was training, we essentially intubated, or at least did direct laryngoscopy for any baby with meconium aspiration or meconium around. And so obviously that's awful, and that's a thing of the past, and it was shown to be completely useless. But I had looked at thousands and thousands of larynxes, and, you know, not to blow my own trumpet or anything, but I'm pretty good at intubating. And my trainees now, they're like, they hardly ever do it. And these are in trainees in neonatal medicine, and they're not as good, and our success rate intubation do drop off. So, you know, that's an interesting thing to weigh up, isn't it? If we then move to doing much more, less invasive airway support, then when it really comes to it and you need to intubate the baby, your skills might be less. But there's other ways around that through, you know, using video laryngoscopes, etc.
Alice, have we got things from Twitter?
So comments that we have a lot of people resonating with the idea of the drought when it comes to procedures. Claire, Emma, Jenny Worrell and Danny Hall all clearly
felt don't worry, it's normal.
Identify with that. And with regards to your idea of things that can't be published but people wish a neonatologist had told them, the DFTB team themselves tweeted saying this is what we're all about.
Oh,
so that's nice.
Thank you. Super. We've got time for one last question in the room. Anybody else?
Sorry, it wasn't a question. It was more a comment again. And it's this time of YouTube, which is really to say that these procedures now, so many of them are available to be reminded of, to be initiated by thinking through the process and therefore learning the process, yeah, with modelling, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think mental modelling is really important, but I, like I said about the violin player, there isn't any shortcut to just doing it. I mean, doing it on a mannequin at least, but it's a muscle memory thing. It really is, and something like intubating a 24-weeker, it's millimetres of difference, and there's no other way to do it. It's practice, practice, practice.
Okay, well, I have learnt a huge amount from you guys, so thank you very much, and could you all join me in just giving them one last thing?
Hello and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB 19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy!